This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
This is not the future we were promised. Like, how about that for a tagline for the show?
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work and your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
This is Lady Killers, where history meets true crime from BBC Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley. I'm joined by a crack team of all-female detectives to investigate the ordinary lives and extraordinary crimes of Victorian murderesses. I'm taking a look, well, a feminist look, actually, at the wild and unthinkable crimes supposedly committed by different murderesses from Victorian Britain, North America, and beyond. We hear their words, we hear their voices. And we ask, what do these lady killers tell us about the world in which they lived? And how different is it today for women who kill? When a woman is accused of murder, it's always a sensation. And in this first episode, we're exploring one of the most sensational cases of the Victorian age. It was on the front page of every newspaper.
Here it is, the old story, the gay young widow of Balham. A life of dissipation, folly and vice. Just one panic.
The daily mess of loathsome scandal put before the public in the newspapers has given just offence to all rational and decent people.
Now, our first alleged lady killer is Florence Bravo. A rich, beautiful, scandalous young widow who found herself at the centre of a media storm after the mysterious death of her husband. I went to Balham in South London to find out what happened. So this is the Priory. I've been longing to come here because it's the centre of such a glamorous mystery. It's a big white house. It's sparkling in the sunshine today. Oh, it's got battlements, it's got little turrets. And it was here on the 21st of April, 1876, a man called Charles Bravo died. After 3 days of agony, he'd been poisoned. And he'd been married to his wife, Florence, for just 5 months. Today, the house is all jostled by other houses and flats, but back then, it had 10 acres of gardens, it had an orchard, inside it had a gracious curving staircase, it had a butler, there were lots of other servants, and it was owned by a woman. Florence Bravo leased this house with the £40,000 she'd inherited from her first husband. This is before Charles. And I'm glad that she got something out of him because he'd been a dreadful, abusive husband until he drank himself to death. Then after that, Florence had had a scandalous affair with a doctor twice her age, and this had damaged her reputation. It's easy to see why she'd married Charles Bravo, very personable, an upcoming lawyer. She needed the respectability of a second marriage. And it's easy to see why Charles had married Florence. She was young and beautiful, but perhaps most importantly, she had all this money. And this sets the scene for one of the most famous murder mysteries of the Victorian age, the Balham Mystery. Charles was in for a nasty surprise. In the 19th century, when a woman married, everything she owned became the property of her husband. Wealthy women could get round this through equity law, which allowed them to put their assets under the protection of a trust. This is what Florence did. The 1870 Married Women's Property Act, which gave married women some rights over certain forms of property, further strengthened Florence's position. And this had made Charles very cross. He'd married Florence for her money, then found that he didn't have as much control over it as he'd expected. To help me unpick this case and to explore the issues it still raises today, I'm joined by the leading criminal barrister, Sasha Woss, QC, who's worked on many high-profile cases, including those of Rosemary West, Rolf Harris, and Johnny Depp. Now, Sasha, this marriage was clearly not going well at the time that Charles Bravo died. And one of the major sources of conflict was control over money. Is that something that you still see in the married couples you represent today?
Much less so. I think if one looks at Florence's marriage to Charles, he married her because although he had status, he actually had very little money of his own. Nowadays, there is less of an economic feature with marriages, certainly amongst the majority of people.
So this is quite an alien concept to us, a marriage that at its heart is about money. It's a trade-off, it's a deal, it's a bargain. Let's see how they're going to negotiate this when it all goes wrong. So, what exactly happened on the evening of the 18th of April, 1876, at the Priory, just 5 months into the Bravos' marriage? Charles and Florence Bravo sit down to dinner with Florence's paid companion, Mrs. Jane Cox. According to the butler, the atmosphere is tense. Mrs. Cox is just back from Worthing, where she's been looking at a holiday house for Florence to let. Charles, by the way, thinks it's too expensive. And Charles is in pain after a horse riding accident that afternoon. Various issues are simmering away. Money, of course. And Florence is expected to resume sexual relations now she's considered recovered from her second miscarriage in 4 months. There's ongoing jealousy from Charles over Florence's affair with that doctor, much older than her, Dr. Gully, and drink is taken. Charles is often critical of Florence's drinking, but all three of them are at it. The butler that evening has brought out 2 bottles of Burgundy, a bottle of sherry, and a bottle of Marsala as well. That's an ocean of wine. After this tense evening, they all go upstairs, Charles and Florence to separate bedrooms. She has another sherry. And not long afterwards, Charles is calling out in agony. He's being terribly sick. He's vomiting. It takes him 3 agonising days to die. 6 doctors fail to save him. The post-mortem shows he's been poisoned with at least 30 grains of antimony, a heavy metal. And the consensus is that it had been put into his bedside glass of water. There's a rushed inquest. Florence isn't even called as a witness. This causes an outrage, and there's a second inquest called for by Charles's family, and this time Florence has become chief suspect. I went to talk to Rosalind Crone, senior lecturer in history at the Open University and our Lady Killer's in-house historian. We met up in the big function room over the bar of the Bedford Hotel in Balham. It's 1/2 mile away from the Priory. It's down by the railway station. And it was here that this second inquest was held. It lasted a month. I asked Ros why the inquest was held in a pub.
Now, that's a really good question. So pubs and inns were often used for the administration of local justice in the 19th century. Pubs were great because they often had big spaces where you could hold events. So it's important to remember that an inquest is not a trial. The role of the inquest is to determine cause of death and perhaps those who might have been responsible for that death. The coroner would be joined by a jury. 12 men would form the jury. And the first thing that that jury would do would be to go and see the body.
Where was he at this point?
Well, he had already been buried, of course, in Norwood Cemetery. So they took all the jurors down there to see him. They had dug him up specially.
We've got some pictures here of the inquest in progress from this whole publication called The Balham Mystery. Ros, why are there no women present?
Women were actually banned from attending by the coroner. He was concerned that the content of this particular case might be upsetting. It might not sit very well, women's sensitivities.
Does he? Is it the gore, or is it stuff like the previous character of Florence Bravé?
I think it is more to do with the history of Florence. First of all, you've got the premarital affair, and you also have a woman who has tried to potentially kill her husband.
You don't want your wife or your daughter hearing about that, then.
Well, you might like to take a look at this picture here. It's from the Illustrated London News, published during the case, because we do have a woman one.
Who's this? This is
Mrs. Cox.
She's giving evidence.
Yeah, this is Mrs. Cox, the lady's companion, Florence Bravo's companion, giving evidence. She's sitting, but they have raised her chair slightly up.
So she's absolutely the focus of everybody's attention. That's quite a hostile environment.
Yeah, she's in the spotlight, all eyes on her. All of those men squeezing in on her, focused in on her. That's intense.
It's not just Florence's companion, Mrs. Cox, but also her mother and her servants who get cross-examined by the Bravo family's lawyers. Because this inquest, which is supposed to be about the cause of Charles's death, is turning into something else. It's turning into an inquiry into the affair Florence had previously had with Dr. Gully before she married Charles. The Bravo family's lawyers are obsessed with proving that this affair had continued after her marriage, therefore giving her a motive for murder. The inquest culminates in the hugely anticipated appearance of Florence herself on Thursday, August the 3rd, and she's questioned by the barrister, Sir Henry James.
What did you tell your husband about Dr. Gully before your marriage?
I told Mr. Bravo everything. That for some time I had been in Dr. Gully's society constantly. That I had been on journeys with him at home and abroad. And that I went to Kissingen alone with him. I told him all. I have to state that there was at one time an improper intimacy between myself and Dr. Gully. There was... On returning to England from Kissingen, I suffered from illness and I was then attended by Dr. Gully.
That illness was a miscarriage?
It was. And I did my utmost to conceal the fact of that from everybody about me.
I notice that certain persons here are making sketches of the witness, and I hope that this will not be persisted in. Had you said anything to Dr. Gully about his continued residence near your home, the Priory in Balham?
I had told Dr. Gully it would be wiser for him to remove, and this would be less painful to both of us than his continued residence near. Dr. Gully's continued residence was known to Mr. Bravo. He often expressed himself angrily in regard to this continued residence of Dr. Gully near the Priory. Though Mr. Bravo had promised not to mention Dr. Gully's name, he often did mention his name. He was always abusing Dr. Gully. He used to say that he wished Dr. Gully was dead, and it angered him to pass Dr. Gully's house every morning.
In the room at the Bedford Hotel in Balham, where Florence gave this painful evidence, I asked Ros Crone about the media frenzy which surrounded the case.
The Bravo inquest attracted such a huge amount of public interest. As you can imagine, there were crowds arriving every day that it was on, hanging around outside waiting for the latest news. So many people that the police had to be called down to do crowd control.
And it was reported on.
Yes. Took up an immense amount of space in newspapers. At the top, you had the respectable press, the Times, the Daily Telegraph, and they were reporting on every day of the inquest.
And it lasted nearly a month, didn't
it? That's right, yeah. And then at the more sleazy end, you had publications like the Illustrated Police News pumping out pictures as well as comment and text, yeah.
Some quite judgmental journalism here. You said the Illustrated Police News. Their guy says, oh, this about Florence. In her youth, she must have been an exceedingly handsome girl. And although still prepossessing, she may be said to be slightly passé. What?
That's actually pretty cruel. And, of course, we have the book that came out after the event, the famous Balham Mystery. It was published in penny numbers.
Yeah.
So the price, of course, being an indication of its reach, how many people could afford this. And it included the whole inquest, complete with pictures of the house, floor plans of the house, pictures of all the characters.
If all this is being published as the inquest is going on, well, it's kind of a trial by media as well, at the same time, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
How would you sum up the way that the media depicted Florence?
She's a rich, beautiful widow, wrapped up in this potential murder of her husband. So ultimately, dangerous.
Glamorous and dangerous.
Sasha Woss, what do you think of this feeding frenzy going on in the Victorian press? Does it sound familiar?
The tabloid press, and indeed all the press, can be very cruel. There is a type of reporting in the tabloid press which loves sensationalism. It loves judging the people who are either on trial or giving evidence. And that feeds into a particular type of audience of people who think that they are able to look down on people that they wouldn't necessarily look down on normally because of the circumstances of the case.
Mm. Does it get in the way of you doing your job as a barrister?
I think nowadays the rules against the press reporting are much stricter. In fact, I know they're much stricter than they were in the Victorian time, because if a trial is pending and publication of material could prejudice the fairness of a trial, that could be the subject of a contempt of court hearing.
And Sasha, what about social media? Does that get in the way of courtroom business today?
Social media is practically unregulated and unpoliced, and it is a real problem. Jurors are told not to look at the internet, not to look at what's on social media. And what is on social media could potentially be absolutely devastating to the fairness of a trial. There's no doubt about that.
Interesting. So you, looking at the evidence in this case, will completely set aside all of this all of this newspaper gush that was appearing.
I think what was interesting about this case was the way in which the coroner permitted the concentration of questions on Florence's personal life, which wasn't the central point of the inquest.
What actually interests me in this case is the way that it was so widely reported. And I'm fascinated by the idea that this must have kicked off so many different conversations across Britain about, you know, lovers, adultery, matrimony, money. I imagine women reading about this in the newspapers and thinking, how does this relate to me? Is our society the way it should be?
I think the interest in the case was that suddenly subjects which were only reported in a certain type of novel, which respectable women didn't read, suddenly this was all out into the open. And people felt they could discuss it as a legitimate topic of public concern rather than some rather racy novel that they prefer not to be associated with.
So the public is hugely engaged in this case. And there's this fascinating Victorian phenomenon of people sending in letters to the police with their own theories about Charles's death. And I think this also had something to do with the newfound popularity of detective fiction. Everybody wants to be an armchair detective. So we have letters saying, have you thought about the fact that Mrs. Florence may have been having an affair with Mrs. Cox, who was actually a man? Two people thought that the poison was in the salt on the dinner table. And a former judge at the High Court of Madras, do you know what he thought?
No.
That the butler did it.
Who else?
Oh, with all this going on, there's just no let up for Florence. She's back on the stand for a third day of questioning yet again about her affair with Dr. Gully. And now she's at breaking point.
My attachment to Dr. Gully has nothing to do with this case of the death of Mr. Charles Bravo. As to that, I will answer any question. I have been subjected to sufficient pain and humiliation already, and I appeal to the coroner and to the jury as men and as Britons to protect me. I think it is a great shame that I should be thus questioned. And I will refuse to answer any further questions with regard to Dr. Gully.
Sasha, are women still put on trial for their sexual behaviour like this?
That is almost unknown nowadays. There are protections that have been brought into the legislative books forbidding cross-examination about previous sexual history. And in most cases, and in particular in Florence's case, I suspect a modern judge would have simply prevented that detail of cross-examination, and she wouldn't have had the ordeal that she did have.
Towards the end of the inquest, a very revealing statement is read out. The statement that Florence had made to a solicitor 2 months previously about the state of her marriage.
My income was about 3,000 a year. He had nothing but a very small income of his own, 200 a year. He was pressing me to put down my garden and my horses, my two great hobbies, and to turn away my companion, Mrs. Cox, to save money. He was a very passionate man, and short-tempered to the last degree. He once struck me because his mother was interfering in my household arrangements, requiring me even to put down my maid. He continued very angry when we got to bed that night, and threatened to cut his throat. On Good Friday last, I had just recovered from my second miscarriage. He got in an awful passion because I was very weak, and had only left my bed that day after 10 days. And he did not like me asking to be left alone to rest. I was frightened.
He got in an awful passion. He did not like me asking to be left alone to rest. I was frightened. Now, this is super interesting, Sasha, isn't it? What does this behaviour by Charles Bravo sound like to you?
Well, Lucy, this sounds like classic coercive controlling behaviour. But just to be clear, coercive and controlling behaviour does not entitle a woman to kill the person who's controlling her, usually her husband. She has to establish that the coercive and controlling behaviour had such an effect on her mental state that her mental state resulted in her killing, and her responsibility for the killing was diminished in law. And that would reduce her responsibility for murder and translate it to manslaughter.
Sasha, what do you make of Florence's mental state?
I think all of this points to somebody who is really spiralling downwards. And it's of significance that she was drinking that amount of alcohol.
It's so fascinating to me that I think Florence is giving herself a really good motive for murder in her statement. But the all-male inquest, they don't get this at all. They're just fixated on something else, totally different, her supposed sexual immorality. They were looking in the wrong place. I'm wondering if they had been women on the jury at this inquest instead of men, wherever they might have spotted this. Because these are women's problems that we're talking about.
The unhappiness she felt at the hands of her husband and his controlling behaviour would have given her much stronger motive to get rid of him.
So after a whole month of questioning and discussion, what was the verdict of the coroner's court?
We find that Charles Delaunay Turner Bravo did not commit suicide, that he did not meet his death of misadventure, that he was willfully murdered by the administration of tartar emetic. But there is insufficient evidence to fix the guilt upon any person or persons.
Sasha, as a barrister, what do you think about this inquest then? Was it a good investigation or was it pretty hopeless?
I certainly don't think it was hopeless. There was a lot of attention paid to the cause of death, the effect of the poison, how the poison could have been administered. Where the inquest went off the rails, in my opinion, was once Florence's private life became a feature. The coroner just allowed this cross-examination to go on relentlessly. And people were so obsessed by the scandalous element about it, they lost sight of what they were actually supposed to be doing.
Back at the Bedford Hotel, there was one last thing I wanted to ask historian Ros Crone.
I'm so intrigued by this theory about the poison Florence may have used, antimony. There was discussion of this at the inquest. We had one witness who's a chemist. He said, I know of cases where women put tartar emetic, that's antimony, into wine to cure their husbands of their fondness for it. Have you heard of antimony being used in that way before?
Yes, well, antimony was a substance that had been used for hundreds of years, actually, as an emetic. So I brought some pictures here from the Wellcome collection. You can see this woodcut here from about 1690 of a man being sick after taking antimony. So it's quite a common poison, in fact, but in big doses, it could prove fatal.
So it's like Alka-Seltzer on steroids.
So I guess in this case, it could be that Florence used antinomy to perhaps control her husband Charles's drinking, perhaps to get him to leave her alone.
I mean, it would explain why someone gave Charles Bravo antimony and why that someone might well have been his wife.
Well, she was questioned about that. She denied having purchased it, denied using it, denied ever having any knowledge of it.
Well, do you think it's really likely that Florence had never, ever heard of antimony? It was quite commonly used for treating horses, wasn't it?
Yeah, we know that she was a horsewoman and she loved her horses very much. We also know that her groom had bought some antimony, so it was lying around the place. Her first husband was a drinker as well. Perhaps she had experience using it with him. So there are all these kind of smoking guns, but she denies having any knowledge of it.
Well, wouldn't you? Of course you would. Come on, she did it.
Sasha, what do you think then? Do you think it's possible that Florence got away with murder?
I think that a tenacious police officer and a robust Crown Prosecution Service lawyer could have mounted a case against Florence. She had the motive, she had the means, and she had the opportunity. So it was a circumstantial case, but I think they could have mounted a case.
I'm sort of sorry to tell you this. Even though this went no further legally for Florence, her life was ruined, because despite all of her money, Florence died just 2 years later. She was aged 33. She died in a villa in Southsea in 1878 under an assumed name. And how did she die? She drank herself to death. So Florence Bravo avoided the gallows. In fact, she avoided being prosecuted at all. But she didn't really get away with anything, did she, Sasha?
No, she didn't. Her last 2 years of life were miserable. She had to live in secret. And really, all she did was to drink herself to death.
When you look at Florence Bravo, do you see a ruthless poisoner or somebody who was in a tough place, somebody who'd been abused?
She was really at her wit's end. She'd realised she was in the most terrible situation. And she had to get away from him. And you could see how she might have been driven to that.
If we're thinking about guilt, I think that in a way it was her husbands, both of them, who got her into drinking in the first place and who were cruel to her, sort of killed her themselves. Well, thank you ever so much to historian Ros Crone and to Sasha Woss QC. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to Glasgow to look at a time when young love goes wrong. Meet Madeline Smith, the privileged Scottish young lady who, when threatened with blackmail by her lover, is accused of taking deadly measures.
Lady Killers is presented by me, Lucy Worsley, and produced by Jane Greenwood. The music's composed by Asher Nathan and the sound design is by Chris McLean. The readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Tell me this. Would you like to be a princess?
There was always talk about, oh my God, Prince Harry was in Mahiki last night. How exciting. And then we'd all go to Mahiki the next night because Prince Harry was there.
Would it be liberating?
You couldn't believe the ferociousness with which she just fought restlessly for inequality and always championed the underdog.
Glamorous?
They all knew that Victoria Davis was a very special little girl at the end of term. This royal coach would rock up at the school and take her away to wherever the royal family were staying.
Or perhaps just a bit sad.
She was not cast in a Vogue photo shoot because the people running the shoot decided that she was too large. She wasn't slim enough.
I'm Anita Arnand, and for my new podcast on BBC Radio 4, I'll be exploring the complicated idea of the princess. I'll be sitting down with actors like Meera Syal, authors like Kate Moss, and TV presenters and comedians like Toff and Russell Kane to get their favourite princesses, historical or fictional. So, from Princess Leia and Grace Kelly to Mongolian wrestler Cuchulainn and the little girl Queen Victoria fondly called her African princess, Do join me, Anita Arnand, for Princess on BBC Radio 4. Subscribe on BBC Sounds.
This is not the future we were promised. Like, how about that for a tagline for the show?
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work and your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.